Hello, everyone, and welcome to Conversations on Sex, Addiction, and Relationships. And I am Wendy Conquest, and I'm here with Dan Drake, Tim Stein, and Jeannie Vitone. And I'm very, very excited today. We have a special guest. We have Dr. Rob Weiss, who is the Chief Clinical Officer with Seeking Integrity in Los Angeles. And I think we've all known Rob for a number of years. So he's a licensed professional, has been so for many years, and has authored 11 books. He has over 1 million downloads of the podcast Sex, Love, and Addiction. And he's one of the reasons that I'm very excited to have Rob on today is that he has created and maintained different treatment centers. And so when we talk about people going to treatment, the question is, right, when do they go to the treatment? What's the right treatment center? How do treatment centers vary? Am I going to be able to afford it? There's just so many questions that people have at that particular time when they're seeking a treatment for sex addiction or betrayal trauma. So I'm really, really excited to hear Rob's input on that. So how are you all doing, and how are you doing with Rob coming on board?
I'm just listening, and you know, I've known Rob a long time, not well, and always looking for more opportunities to get to know him. But this fellow's been around for decades doing so many different things, and you know, 11 books, a million on the podcast. I mean, just and just touched the lives of so many people through all the different treatment modalities he's done. I'm just beyond happy that Rob is, Dr. Rob has decided to come and visit us. So what about you guys?
Well, honestly, I mean, Dr. Rob's done so much over the, like you said, I just think of the face of our community, of our field, and how much you've, I think of, I don't know, debates that he's done with other people that have been, you know, anti-sex addiction, and just being at the forefront of our field for so long. So such an ambassador for our field. I'm really excited to have him.
I can tell all kinds of stories about Dr. Rob and how much I appreciate him and how influential he's been for me, but I would say, let's just bring him on. And
let's bring him.
That sounds like
welcome,
a great.
Welcome, Dr. Rob.
Hey guys.
Hey.
Can I tell you that when you say all that stuff, I just feel older and older. And he's done this, and he's done, like, okay, they're reading my eulogy there. Thank you so much. But yeah, you know, I think whatever we have, we need to give as much as we can back on any level. And I'm very grateful to be able to do that. And I'm glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, can we maybe start there? Because you have given so much. I mean, you used to run, I think it was an online 12-step meeting for people who needed some guidance. You have supported so many CSATs in our own development, you know, through your organization, sexandrelationshiphealing.com and Seeking Integrity. You've created online support groups for addicts and for partners out there, and, you know, for professionals, you make that available too. You have spoken pro bono at different 12-step conferences. Tell us what your motivation is, because you, more than anybody else, has just stepped so heavily into giving back to the recovery community. And I have always so admired that.
Well, I guess, first of all, I want to say that I was given two. And when I think about the, you know, the founder of our field, Dr. Patrick Carnes, I was thinking about Pat the other day, and it's like, I would not be alive. I would have died of AIDS many, many years ago had I not heard the words of someone who said, this is a problem. These are issues you can deal with. It's a real thing. It doesn't mean you're a bad person and you can get better. And, you know, that to me, I just never thought that that could happen and that I could have. I've been married 22 years. I mean, never crossed my mind. I couldn't get through a date, truly. Can I tell you why, though? I won't tell you why I couldn't get it through a date, because I would act out all the time sexually. And I was so naive that I would have a date in the evening. I would say, oh, let me tell you all the people I had sex with this afternoon. And for some reason, they didn't want to go out with me again. So, and that's true. I truly believe, and I think us therapists get kind of, don't see through a lens that's real. We are so used to people coming to us and they have insurance and they have money and they have awareness, they've read books. And I, as a social worker, which is my background, I think about resources that people who don't have access to that need. And, you know, we have 14 free groups on Seeking Integrity, you know, whether it's Betrayed Partners. I don't need to get into the details. All I want to say is that every person we can help who's not able to get help on their own is, you know, is such a gift. And fortunately, Tim, you know, I've had a lot of people who volunteer. I mean, it isn't just me. I don't run all these groups. You know, I have therapists who also have a servant's heart, who also are motivated to do this work. And so it isn't just me. I open a door and people walk through it. I also like a lot of attention. So anything I can get to validate, you know, that's true, but it's also a little bit of amusement. I think people who do this work are driven to do it. I don't think I have a choice. I think this is, and once I discovered that I could have a life, man, did I want to pass down to other people. But originally it was because I didn't want people to die of AIDS. That was the original reason I got in the field, because they were having sex in ways that they didn't understand why they were having it. And it wasn't a good idea the way they were doing it, but they did it anyway, you know? So I'm inspired by the people who gave it to me. I'm amazed that I got to have the life I have. And I'm incredibly appreciative and grateful to the people who have the same vision as I do. Well, let's give as much of it away as we can.
I'm curious, Dr. Rob, how did you morph? You said your initial vision was, you know, to help people not die of AIDS, and obviously it's shifted. It's, I mean, I'm assuming that's part of your core vision still, but what are the I don't know, evolutions of your vision along the way, and how did you make those transitions?
I think that, you know, AIDS became a more manageable and somewhat treatable illness, and people weren't dying in the ways that they had been. So the immediate focus on that had changed. And what I noticed was tech. I started to see in the late 90s, I think a colleague of mine, Jennifer Schneider, Dr. Schneider and I were the first people who wrote a book about problem porn online. And that was in 1998, you know, when people were dialing up and trying to, you younger folks won't know that, but it was a challenge to get online. But if you were a sex addict, you wanted to get online, believe me, you could. And I started, so I think the interest that I had and what I still have has always been in the sort of cutting edge of what gets people in trouble, you know, and right now I'm looking at deep fake porn, you know, and I'm looking at how AI is going to affect, you know, the ways that people create things. And so to me, it's very interesting. The first thing I think of is, how is the sex act going to misuse this? How are they going to make it into a problem in their lives? Because I can already anticipate. Mm-hmm. So I guess the transition has been from the immediate issue that I came in for, which was HIV and all that, to seeing the larger thing, which is, what are so many people like me struggling with? And I'll say one more thing. I love writing. And what people don't know is I often write about myself, but I don't say that. I say, you know, Jack was doing this and Jack was doing that, but I can imagine myself doing it. I can remember doing it. And I think all of you understand that the best of us understand what goes on the head of many of our clients, or whether we've met some or known some. And so I think part of it is moving into embracing more of what happened to me and what I went through, and giving it a voice that applies in a much larger way to other people. Oh, and I was on Oprah. that definitely, by the way, that means nothing to anyone, but it's just such a, like, got to check the box kind of thing.
And Katie Kirk too, right?
I was on Katie Kirk. I was on, you know, I actually have a friend of mine framed it. I have a Time magazine article about Bill Clinton, and they asked me to comment on his issues. And so, yeah, I have always, I mean, that's the other piece. I'm not afraid of, this is the flip side of needing a lot of attention, is I'm not afraid to go out there and try to get it. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, we say in 12-step programs that, you know, basically that we can turn our lemons into lemonade. And for me, every single bad experience I had in the way I lived or what happened to me, I can turn it around and help other people understand how they got here. And I try to do it in a big way, you know, as big as I can, whether that's TV or Of course, they always call me when some man in public has gotten in trouble. And they say, why would this guy who has everything and he's so handsome, that why would he do this? And, you know, my answer, because he's very troubled.
I have a question. It's been burning for me for many years now. And that is, in the Western world, as you said, people can afford therapy, not everyone, but so I've had this goal to try to reach the truck driver in India that's addicted to porn.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we do that? How do we reach out to other cultures, people who speak different languages, but sex addiction is worldwide. Through Facebook, I get questions from people from Saudi Arabia and Indonesia and the Philippines. And, you know, how do I stop this behavior?
Well, you're doing it. Don't you realize that? Podcasts don't just air in the United States. They air in Sri Lanka. They air in Kuala Lumpur. They air in South America. You know, when I first started a podcast, I was like, oh, okay. So, you know, someone in Ohio or whatever. I forgot that there were people going to be listening in Africa and in Europe. And so what you're doing right here is an opportunity to reach the whole world. And I do get notes from people. In fact, so there's the podcast, there's blogs, people read, you know, we have the opportunity to reach the whole world in ways that we never could before. When I had to publish a book in 1998, who found it? Who talked about it? Who, I mean, that was it. Now I can, you know, write a blog about it. And like I said, 8 million people have downloaded my psychology blog. So I think it's a nature of what's happened with the world and those of us who are willing to stand up and take these kinds of risks. I will say that there's a real dearth of people who will translate. And that bothers me. I get notes from people who are in countries that have languages other than our own. And they say, you know, I need this translated into German, or I need this translated into, you know, Portuguese. And I think we are lacking. And by the way, if anyone's listening to this, feel free to volunteer. We're lacking the ability to speak to people in their own language. Right. And I think and I'm not even talking about culture. I'm just simply listening to what we're saying. And so I think that there are still obstacles. But guys, you're doing it. You're reaching the whole world right here, right now. So thank you. I do want to say one more thing about that. It is the greatest gift to me. I really want you to know this is my favorite, favorite, favorite thing of all the work, which is when I get a note from someone halfway across the world who says to me, I read one of your books. I was desperate. I thought I was a bad, terrible person, whatever. You helped me understand what's wrong with me, and it gave me hope for change. I will never meet them. I'll never know them. I'll never spend time with them. We'll never speak. But something I did made a difference in their lives. And to me, I love talking to people in person. I love doing therapy, all that. But to me, like, that is the greatest gift, is to be able to give something away that someone comes back and said, you changed my life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we are putting that stuff out there. So I'm grateful to you. I'm grateful to be had a chance to do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Nice.
I think that turning the conversation a little bit, one of the things that you've done multiple times is the treatment centers and the residential inpatients. There's so much to learn there, because we, in our podcast, we haven't gotten into that population, that service offering. And so we're, you know, I'm thinking today, here you are having done this multiple times, and let's talk about that. What's an appropriate client? How did you come to be creating that? What's the partner sensitivity part when
okay,
the
Jeannie,
addict is in recovery?
You have to ask me, I'm very old and I don't remember things. And so you have to say one at a time.
All right, gosh.
No, I'll write them down, but they're all great questions. I won't remember them. So.
Yeah, no, totally fine. This is the way my brain thinks. It just kind of goes boof.
Yes, so we have medication for that.
Dr. Rob, absolutely. So I'll go back. Well, I'll settle my brain down first. Treatment centers are a topic that we haven't gotten into. How did you start? Because you have created and run and worked at numerous over time.
So that's where I was trained. My first job was with Patrick Carnes in a place in Torrance, California. I was hired as a social worker. I was hired right out of school. I was hired. I couldn't understand why they wanted me. Now I like gay sex addict. You know, at that time, I was like, why open mind? You know, I didn't think of why the heck. Now I understand what they wanted. But I trained with Dr. Carnes there. He was my first sort of role model. And so I spent 4 years really learning from one of the better, I think one of the best programs is no longer around. And I saw the value of it. And I saw the difference it made people's lives. And so Lord knows why, but I said, I'm going to go out there and do some of this myself. And in 1995, I opened a program and I've been doing it ever since. I've opened one for the US military. I've opened one in Thailand. I mean, lots of different places. And there is so let me tell you what I think people need to be in a higher level of care. I look at treatment of addiction as a continuum, just like medical care. You know, if you cut your finger and a Band-Aid works, great. If you cut your finger and the Band-Aid doesn't work, maybe you need some antibiotic cream. Or if that doesn't work, go to the doctor. If that doesn't work, go to the specialist. So you go along a kind of line of getting of escalation of higher and higher levels of needing things. And so I think in our field as well, you know, you start with a support group, you read a book. Does that change things? You need to see a therapist. Okay, I'm going to a group. I'm going twice a week. Now I'm going to a weekend, you know, workshop. And I think when there's a point at which that isn't enough to help people stop their behavior and the risks they're taking by doing it, then I say, you know, you've tried a lot of stuff and you've put yourself into it and it hasn't worked. And so what residential treatment is, it is 24/7 containment and support. We try to do them in nice places. You know, I want people to feel, I don't want them worrying about the food. I don't want them worrying about, is their bed comfortable? What they need to be focused on is the work that we do. But at a certain level of, and also there are people who are, you know, they're going to kill themselves. They're going to give someone a disease. They're going to, you know, whatever it is. And so there's a certain level at which people need residential care. And I have to say, for me as a therapist, and please, it's a great place to play. Like I am at my best when, like I did today at Seeking Integrity, I've got 8 guys in a room and we're trying to figure out the thing out together. And my skill set of evaluating, challenging, confronting, laying out, all of my skills are best expressed in that environment. So some of it is me, some of it is what I experienced watching it happen, but they're all levels of care, right? So it really is just matched to kind of how dangerous that person's behavior is, how much they need to be safe. And I'll say one more thing, a lot of referrals that we get are from men who are about to lose their relationship. They're about to lose their family. You know, that they've done so much cheating, so much acting out, and their spouses, if you don't go get some help, and I mean real help, then you're going to lose me. And a lot of men come in as, you know, we don't see the dangers of smoking. We don't see the dangers of HIV. We don't. But when we think about losing someone important in our lives, boy, does that change everything. And I think that those people who are desperate to not be disconnected from the people they love are willing to do whatever it takes to hold on to those relationships. And that also is a reason why they go to residential.
When you say it hasn't worked, that's an interesting phrase, right? So because certainly we've all had clients who they get sober and then 6 months later they relapse and they say, well, it was relapse. It was, you know, once in 6 months. So do I really need to do residential? So when, you know, this is a tough question. When
would you know that when, you want to go, that you need to go? Never.
You never know.
In doing this work for probably 1,000 people over 30 years, I've been licensed 30 years. I've met probably 3 people who said, I want to get help because I want to be a better person. 3 out of 1,000. Every addict of every stripe, alcohol, drugs, gambling, whatever, they come into treatment because they're in crisis. You know, they lost their job. They got found out. There was a legal case. Their spouse is leaving them. They got hooked on drugs and they keep pairing the two. So, you know, I think that crisis is an opportunity. And everyone, no one wants to go to residential treatment. Who wants to cut out of your life, check in, do nothing but work on yourself? You know, nobody really wants to do that. But they, you know, we say when the pain of what you've been doing is greater than the pain of getting well, then people don't want to be in that pain and they come in. I do want to say something about, though, and because I hear this a lot in the media, which is, oh, they just went to treatment to get out of their consequences. They just went to treatment so everyone can feel bad about them. You know, they don't really have a problem. They're just trying to have everyone feel sorry for them. And my answer is yes. Yes, they're going to treatment to have excuses. Yes, they're going to treatment so everyone thinks well of them. Yes, they're going to treatment because it's a problem and, you know, all that stuff. But that doesn't matter to me. What happens is what happens when they get there. I'm not interested in what gets in there. What I want them is in the door, and the rest we can do together. The one thing I can't do, though, and this is very important for me to say, I can look at past trauma. I can look at people's acting out. I can help them be better family members. I can certainly help them stop acting out. And I can lay out a roadmap for how they might live their lives in a healthy way going forward. But the one thing I can't do is produce motivation. You have to want to get well, even if it's to save your marriage or whatever. You have to want to get well. It has to be more important than work or spending time on the holiday. You have to want this. And once you, for whatever, you want to not be in trouble, great. But there are reasons that people want this, and usually because they don't want to lose what they have. And if they don't do it, they're going to.
Well said. I've seen that so much, and people will blame us. Like we failed them because we didn't fix them or something. And I completely agree. I think that's so important. I don't want people to miss that, how important that motivation is.
Well, they blame everybody.
Well,
I'm sorry, Tim.
I was just going to say that when it comes to motivation, you know, I also recognize that motivation is going to shift and change over time. Like I know for myself, my motivation when I finally got sober was the recognition of how much I was harming my wife and how much impact it was going to have on my kids. While that's still important to me now, my primary motivation is I like who I am in recovery. I like who I am sober. I'm a better husband, better father, better friend, better clinician. I'm a better human being. And that's my primary motivation. But I wasn't able to start there. And I tell the story about my grandfather, who was a smoker. And before I was born, according to the family story, he walked into the lunchroom at work and announced to the lunchroom, "I'm going to quit smoking." And some guy in the lunchroom looked at him and said, "Right, Stein, I'll believe it when I see it." And my grandfather said, "Well, what do you mean?" He's like, "I don't know how many times you told us you were going to quit smoking and you haven't." Pissed my grandfather off. And so he, you know, threw the pack of cigarettes away. And according to the family, never smoked again for the rest of his life. But the question of motivation comes up. Was his motivation to be, you know, a better role model, to not smell like smoke, to all those kind of things? Later on, maybe. But what was his motivation to stop smoking? His motivation was there was no way on God's green earth he was going to let that guy be right. And if that's the motivation that he needed to have to get on that path, fine. So I don't care what people's motivation is to start with. It will evolve over time. Just whatever gives you traction and motivation to start this work, hold on to it.
You made me smile because I'm very tough on people. I mean, it's part of one of my gifts. I am compassionate. I care about them, but I am very tough on them. And sometimes, in fact, I have some Yelp reviews. They're like, "I got well, but he's not very net," whatever it is. And I think, well, that's a compliment. But I have had people in treatment say, "I don't like you so much that I'm going to get well just to show you that I can." And I'm like, okay, hate me all the way into recovery. It's fine with me, you know, because you're right. Whatever gets them there. But what you said, I think, is really important, which is, and it's really important to me with the men I work with, is they'll always want their families to work out. They'll always, I mean, you don't want to lose your job. You don't want to have your family. You don't want to get a disease, or, you know, none of us want those things, and you won't want those things all the way along. But what I talk to them about is, who do you want to be when you look in the mirror? Who do you want to see? That's who is, you're going to face that person every day, especially older men. And you'd be surprised how many men I work with who are 50 and 60. We have 70-year-olds. Of course, they think they're 30 because they're running around with 25-year-olds. I tell them they're old. They're like, "I'm not old." Like, what do you call a 68-year-old? You know? But one of the things I really try to point out to them is, you know, we have an expiration date. And when you look in that mirror and you know, who is it that you can you respect that person? Can you, I don't think that I want to leave the planet thinking that I disappointed myself deeply. You know, I want to leave saying I did the best I can. And there is one more thing about motivation, which I think is interesting, is the word trying, you know, the word try, you know, I'm trying to quit smoking. I'm really trying hard. I'm trying. I was taught once that, I don't know if you can see my pen, sort of see it, that, so you can probably see it. So I asked clients to hold a pen and I said to them, okay, try to drop it. And they drop it. I'm like, no. Pick the pen back up. Now try harder. And they can't drop it because they're trying. And now I say, drop the pen. And I think that, Tim, that's what you're talking about, is a deep belief to say, I will do whatever it takes. And I don't want to be that person anymore. And not just because of others. I don't want to be that person. Yeah. And I really like what you said about your whole world shifting. You know, a lot of the men I work with, well, my wife is a witch and she just treats me so badly. And no, who wouldn't have sex with 1,000 people if you were married to her? And of course, the question is, how does she get to be that way? How does she get to feel so empty, so anxious, so fearful? How does she get to nag you and be a, because look what you did to her. And you say you love her, but you left her empty and confused and overwhelmed. And, you know, do you want to be that person? Because you don't just have an effect on how you look in the mirror. Everyone in your life is affected, especially your children.
I want to just put a shout out here, is that a lot of the language we're using is male focused.
Yes.
And we have a lot of female addicts and we have a lot of male betrayed partners as well. And so all of this motivation and commitment and rationalization, justification, that can all show up in the female addicts also. And I just kind of want to say that out to the readers.
Jeannie, I really appreciate that. The truth is, you know how I hate talking about myself, but I believe I'm the first person to open a program for women. And in the early 2000s, I in a treatment center and someone said, we need an open program for women. I'm like, I don't know anything about women. That's my response. I know what they look good in, you know, but I don't necessarily know anything about women. And they said, no, you were going to do this. And what we did was we gathered female therapists from all over the country and we asked them, how would you do this? And then we created a program for women. And you're right, because it's so much harder. I mean, you know what a man is when he's having sex with lots of people? He's a stud. You know, no matter how sleazy it is, it's like, oh, he's a stud. But a woman, you know what names we call a woman. And women are acutely aware of how the world looks at them if they're having a lot of anonymous sex or whatever. And of course, I know they have trauma. I know they've been abused. I know what the backstory is. But they just see them through a cultural lens, you know. So to your point, I talk about men because probably 90% of the people who come to treatment are male. You know, women have a lot of shame. And also, by the way, women don't see themselves as sex addicts. Women come in and say, I have relationship problems. I keep picking the wrong person. I date someone and it doesn't work out. It seems to be that what drives women in great part to substance abuse and also to sexual acting out is their relationship. Women are much more relational. And when a relationship fails and you're already broken inside, you know, you might desperately go out and try to seek and whatever you can find. So the reason I say this is, first of all, I run a men's treatment center. Why do I run a men's treatment center? Because women don't want to come to treatment. And I have opened women's programs. You know where they come from? The women in the treatment centers. My clients came from the eating disorder program. My clients came from the substance abuse program because someone was smart enough to say, what is your sexual life and your history? And they would tell the therapist, they're like, oh, you belong in that building. But that woman wouldn't volunteer because she knows how everyone's going to look at her and how she already looks at herself. So I absolutely agree with you, by the way, trans people and gay people, you know, this is not unique to anybody. But I think it's a particularly hard thing for a woman to admit, to come forward. There is one other thing that we need to acknowledge. Men have testosterone and we act out. You know, how many women are in prison for sexual offending compared to men? How many women are in prison for violent crime as opposed to men? We have hormones that make us more aggressive, more assertive, more, some of us, predatory. And so the consequences and the way we do it are much more frequently getting in trouble. Our troubles tends to be greater in this particular area. And I think that simply has to do in part with how we're built. Can I tell a story about that? I love this story. I have, well, I didn't give you an option, but that's okay.
I'm glad that you had awareness about that part, Dr. Rob.
Hey, listen, part of the gift and the curse is I can talk for 3 weeks and not stop. Of course, that doesn't work for my marriage, but you know, it's a particularly useful trait in some ways. But anyway, I was going to tell you a story. And I totally forgot what it's, oh, okay. Sorry. Let me go back to the story. So I have a friend of mine who sadly had prostate cancer, a man. And prostate cancer responds to testosterone. The cancer can grow faster. So they put these men, they reduce their testosterone, and they put them on female hormones. You ladies need to name some of them. Estrogen, for example.
Estrogen.
And I have a really good friend who had, you know, had prostate cancer. And he said, you know, I just look at people and I feel so sad for them. And I sit around and I talk to people who are having trouble and I cry and I feel so emotionally connected. And, you know, this is part of the problem, I think, of, you know, feminism and some of the moves in the past. As we said, this is all how we treat, how we act and how we treat people is primarily, especially in gender, based on how we're raised. You know, if you gave the girl the truck and a pink doll, she could pick either one. And then, but that's not true. Most of the time, the girl's going to pick that pink doll because that is how, that's who she is as a female. I have a really good friend. I know I'm going to get killed by the women's community, but that is true. In fact, for years and years, we could not study biological gender behavior because there was so much anger about, no, no, it's because we live in a men's world. No, it's because we have different hormones. But anyway, so I digress. So I had a woman friend of mine who also had cancer. And what they needed in her particular situation was more male hormones. So they put on her a lot of testosterone. And she said to me, all I can look at is butts. Butts here and butts there. And I see people go to buy and I want to go, hey, nice butt. So, you know, part of it simply is that we're built differently and that we respond to sexuality differently. Men are much more aggressive and much more assertive. And we do objectify more. And you will never take that out of us. We will always objectify the people we're sexually responsive to because we're men and because of the testosterone. So anyway, yes, women come to treatment, but they tend to look differently. They come for different reasons. And sometimes it's hard to parse out, you know, what's they're ashamed of what they do or they're really doing something that's a problem. There's a short answer.
but with what you said, with the objectification piece, this is... All of a sudden, I'm like, whoa, I can hear the listeners going, whoa, because in recovery, we're supposed to be
like women.
Say again.
We're supposed to be like women.
So I remember Dr. Carnes, Patrick Carnes, in one of the CSAT modules saying about scanning behavior and trying to self-soothe as a trauma response for men.
Sure.
So is that scanning and that objectification to calm down, is that hormones or is that a trauma response? And how do we know the difference between the two?
Well, I drink and have a glass of wine to be social and someone else drinks to get drunk. And so, but both of us drink. And so both of us are going to objectify, but we have a term in therapy, right? We call it a secondary gain. Like I drink to be social, but you drink to look social to get drunk. So your real gain is you want to get drunk, but we look like we're doing the same thing. And most men will look at someone and say, looks good to me. And I think that's normative and healthy. And that's part of healthy sexuality for both genders in whatever way they do it. But addicts do the exact same thing for different reasons. I'm staring because I want to dissociate. I'm staring because sexuality helped me soothe myself in a very difficult childhood. I stare because I can, you know, focus on that and not think about my problems. They're doing the same thing, but they're doing it for different reasons. Now, I will say that non-sex addicts will do the healthy thing. They'll look, they'll say, oh, that's great. I want some of that. And then look away. It's a sex addict who stares, who it's like, I'm having five drinks, I'm not having one. So, you know, someone with eating disorder, they both eat, right? But somebody eats so much that they get sick and somebody else. So these are normative behaviors, but like any addiction, they're carried to an unhealthy extreme.
And, you know, piggybacking on that, I think it's always important to recognize that just because someone's in recovery doesn't mean that they're not going to notice other people and find them attractive. It means you're still going to notice people. What do you do with that? Do you notice and move on, or do you notice and take those five drinks?
This is Tim, this is a challenge for spouses.
Yeah.
You know, I understand that if you are the spouse of a sex addict, even someone who's cheated, you're constantly kind of vigilant. Why are they looking at that person? What's on them? You don't trust them anymore. And so you're thinking, oh, well, they must be looking at this person for this reason, or they're about to, you know, they're having affairs, or they want to approach that person. Or, and it's difficult to have, to express healthy sexuality, which is noticing, not staring, and then looking away without a spouse saying you're at it again. And that is their trauma response. That is their, and I've heard stories, if, you know, I'm going to leave you if you look at someone. I know when you're looking at someone, you need to tell me every time you look at someone. It's like, well, but that's not what it's about. You know, I don't necessarily look at someone. Now, do the addicts need some time out? Yeah. But unlike drinking or gambling or the other behavioral addictions, sex is healthy. Eating is healthy. So my denying myself the opportunity to say, oh, that's an attractive person, that's a human response. But it's the staring, it's the second, what am I doing it for? And what am I getting out of it? And that's what treatment is about, because these two people look the same, but their motivation for doing it is completely different.
We definitely, when I'm working with clients on this piece, identifying what is normal, healthy attraction and sexuality. And I like the, I use a similar kind of, I see, I notice, I move along. That's normal. That's to notice who's in the world around you.
That means you're alive.
That means you're, you know, part of the human experience. But like, and I like what you say, the staring, the look back, the double, triple looks. And so that's a really important piece for the addicts and betrayed partners, is defining what's normative, what's healthy, and then what crosses the line. And then what are we going to do about it if it crosses the line? And how are they going to work together if they're in a coupleship to manage healthy sexuality, healthy noticing, and then if it crosses the line?
Well, so in the beginning, it's going to be very narrow. You know, I don't even want you to walk by a bar. Mm-hmm. And 10 years later, we can go to dinner with friends and you're going to have seltzer and I'm going to have a glass of wine. So, you know, in healthy coupleships, I think it that reactivity can reduce. Mm-hmm. But in the beginning, understandably, spouses are so scared and so worried that this is going to happen again and they're not going to know. And the main priority for every spouse, the most important thing is just honesty. I just want to know what's going on. And they think I'm going to start being lied to. By the way, it's also motivation, because when I'm a healthy person, I look at someone, I think, oh, God bless them. They're beautiful. I feel a little aroused by it. That's great. But addicts are looking for validation. Maybe they'll notice me. Maybe they'll see me. Maybe they'll find me attractive. If not then I'm going to go find someone. So the gain is I look to feel important. I look to feel special. I look to be desired. And that's a very different motivation than, oh, I'm human and they look good, and completely different. Looks the same, not the same.
Mm-hmm. 100%. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can I ask a question, Rob? It's Dr. Rob, it's a bit of a departure, but I'm curious. You mentioned before AI, and I know you've had such an interest in technology. You've been at the forefront in our field of like, what's the intersection of the sex field and technology? And I'm just curious, where you see the next frontier? Is it AI? Is it something else? What are you excited about? Or what are you seeing in tech?
Well, I have to tell you just something about that, is that when I first, and I've done hundreds and hundreds of trainings, but as you said, I did a lot of training for us professionals who are trained in this field, the CSAT. And I guess about, it must have been 15 years ago, maybe longer, I got up and I did a lecture on pickup apps. You know, I won't mention their names, but you can look at one and it will geolocate. And people are like, you could geolocate a sex partner? You know, and so to me, it's very important that therapists, I don't know, were you there, Tim? I don't know. People, you're probably too young.
I wasn't there.
Yeah, I was there. It was in the hotel. Yeah, I remember.
Right, it was at one of our conferences.
Yeah, I think I was there.
And I actually put it up online, not the nude pictures, but I was, look, this person's three blocks away. This person's five, you know, reading profiles, but they're not about, you know, I like to swim. And therapists, our therapists, even our therapists, you know, we're not exactly tech people. That's not our world of expertise. And, you know, we're people, you know, and I get, you know, I need an accountant to do my accounting. I'm not good with math. You know, I get that I'm a people person, not necessarily, but us, we need to be more than people. People, we need to understand what our troubled people can access. And AI, for example, when I put all these initials, right, when I put virtual reality and AI together, I have myself walking into an experience that feels like it's actually happening. And I can use I can do deepfake porn, which is, you know, I can take, I don't know, anybody's face, and I can put it on a porn actor, actress. And it's not just like I stuck their face on it. They're smiling, they're engaging, they're, you know. So one of the things I worry about is what happens when anybody can be your porn. The other thing I worry about, and this is another, just how I think, I had the opportunity to do some VR training, if you will. And I put on that headset and I looked at this person who was sad and unhappy and struggling. And I know what we've all been online for therapy these days and all that. And I know what somebody looks like and whether, but I was in that VR room and I felt them. I felt for them. I was like, oh, you know, I feel that must be hard. It was a whole different level of experience. And then I go back to early in my career, some of the earliest days, actually mid-90s, where guys were hooked, and some ladies, on telephone sex. And people would come to me, they spent $5,000 on phone sex. You know, and that's when some grandma in Ohio was 300 pounds would say, oh, you're so sexy and wonderful. And in their fantasies, you know, she was or he was, whoever they were. And I had men who had spent $5,000, $10,000, just unbelievable amounts of money. By the way, trying to get women to say, you're important, I'm interested in you. You know, just to be special is enough to spend all that money. That's that secondary gain. But this is what's going to happen with VR. Because now you're not only talking to somebody, you're actually in the room with them, and you're going to have real feelings about them. And to me, some of those people are never going to leave that room. Talk about being stuck with porn or stuck, you know, that's a two-dimensional experience. So I think I'm always thinking about how will we get in trouble next, because that's how I think about it. Yeah. By the way, I'm a huge Whitney Houston fan. And in a couple of years, if not longer than that, every Whitney song that's ever been recorded and everything she ever said is going to go into AI. And her body and every image that she's ever created in film and personally is going to go into AI. And then we will be able to create new Whitney Houston movies and new Whitney Houston songs, because we literally have every single possible piece of her in an experience that can create new things. And, you know, I will say this, and I'll shut up about that, that in my lifetime and our lifetimes, the greatest technological change was the internet. It changed everything. And out of it, we got everything. But now we're at the next greatest technological change for us and the generation to come, which is AI. And it will change the world. Right now, we're seeing the good parts. Trust me, like the internet, the bad parts are on the way. Oh, let me say something else, because I never stop. Tim Stein's like, oh, is he never going to shut up? You know, it's okay. I do trainings for therapists, right? And now I do them on Zoom. And I'll have a therapist come, someone will say, well, what is some kind of abuse and how does someone recover from it? And so while I'm talking to them, I go to AI and I say, what are five signs of that abuse and what are five ways that someone can heal? And then I turn to the group and say, let me tell you. And they think I'm smart. It's right there. So anyway, enough about that.
Great. I think it's probably time to wrap up. And so Dr. Rob, anything that you want to finish this podcast with?
Well, how can people reach you, Dr. Rob?
Great question.
Well, let me answer the first one really quickly, which is what I want to say, folks, is there is hope. There is hope, and you're not a bad person. You're a broken person. I cannot help bad people, none of us, but we can help broken people. And I think that shift for our clients from I'm unredeemable, who could do this, to wow, I did a lot of screwed up things and I must be really screwed up, is a huge shift. And I think it's really important for us to help people not hate themselves and to share our hope. We see so many people who have lives, who have kids, who feel good, as Tim said, about themselves. And that is, I just want to say it's possible. And with hard work, no matter what format, you can have a real life where you care about yourself and you don't feel that the things you do, other people would, I don't know how to say that, I just lost myself. you don't have to live in a way that leaves you feeling like you're not worthwhile. How do you find me? So here's my email address. Our treatment center is called Seeking Integrity. It's just like the word, two words together, Seeking Integrity, which is, by the way, I think what the recovery process is about. So we're www.seekingintegrity.com. Anyone can write me. Anybody can write me. I am rob@seekingintegrity.com. I always answer. I'm very good at providing resources. I'm going to, you know, say, hey, there's this person named Dan Drake, and I think you should really see him because he's really on top of it. Or so you can always write me. I appear online a lot, Monday nights, every Monday night. I do a live Q&A that's anonymous. What else? The podcast, Sex, Love, and Addiction. The blog, which is Sex and Love in the Digital Age. If you just type in Dr. Rob Weiss sex, you will find me, I promise. And if I can help, I will. It doesn't have to be me. How can I support you in defining what you need? So
thank you, Rob. Thank you, Dr. Rob.
Thank you so much for being with us today. So
I appreciate the invite and what you're doing. And it is the whole world that you're affecting. Just keep that in mind.
A good reminder.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Dr. Rob. Thank you, all our viewers and listeners today. If you like this episode, please like us. And if you know others that would benefit from this, share the link. And please follow us.
And if you have questions you would like us to answer, please send those questions to conversations.sar@gmail.com. We will put those questions in a mailbag and we will answer them with all of our fun, humor, wisdom, and knowledge. Hope you enjoyed this conversation.
Goodbye, everyone.